As we approach Labor Day, can the groundswell of activism that has emerged around Ferguson be directed toward justice and jobs? Coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for August 28, 2014, here on WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. Justice for the occupied, the colonized, those on lockdown, for those under curfew, for those under siege and under apartheid, for the profiled, for the beaten, for the trafficked, for the kidnapped, for the murdered, for the unemployed, for the underemployed, for all the marginalized, for the truth tellers, for the whistleblowers, for the freedom fighters. On the Ground lifts up voices of activists and activism here in the nation's capital. I'm your host, Esther Averam. Well, today we'll have the first of a two-part conversation about the economic contours of and links between Ferguson and the Middle East and beyond, and how the labor movement needs to be involved in this Ferguson moment, and a call for justice and jobs, more the economic justice part of justice. I'll be joined in a few minutes by the author, geopolitical analyst Gerald Horn, by Salim Adofo of the Black United Front, and by the on-the-ground contributor Amani Alkatopa, who just returned from Ferguson, and by columnist Richard Prince of Journalisms. But first, our headlines. Occupy Wall Street protesters have won a legal victory against the New York City Police Department. A federal appeals court has rejected the city's bid to dismiss a lawsuit challenging the NYPD's mass arrest of 700 Occupy demonstrators on the Brooklyn Bridge in 2011. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, which filed the class action suit, called the mass arrest, quote, one of the largest mass violations of civil liberties in U.S. history, end quote. A man in Brooklyn, New York, has also won a $125,000 settlement in a federal lawsuit over his right to document police activity. According to the New York Daily News, Dick George used his cell phone camera to document a police stop and frisk in 2012. After he advised the young people who had been frisked to get the officer's badge numbers next time, George said he was pulled from his car by police and told, "Now we're going to have to give you what you deserve for meddling in our business." He was then arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. Following last month's fatal arrest of Eric Garner, which was caught on cell phone video, the NYPD sent a memo reminding officers the public has a right to record police actions. But Ramsey Orta, who shot the video of Garner's arrest, and Orta's wife have both reported being harassed by police and arrested on unrelated charges since their video was released. In New York City on Saturday, thousands marched in Staten Island to protest the police chokehold death of Eric Garner. A coalition of labor unions endorsed and participated in the march and rally. In Los Angeles, residents have mobilized around the case of Omar Obrego, who witnesses say was beaten by police for 10 minutes before he died, as well as the case of Ezell Ford, whose family says he was unarmed and laying on the ground when he was shot dead by police. Residents marched in Los Angeles last week as part of a national day of rage against police brutality and in solidarity with Ferguson. Meanwhile, in Ohio, one of two police officers involved in the fatal shooting of a young black man inside a Walmart in Beaver Creek is back on the job. When officers confronted John Crawford, he was reportedly holding a BB gun, which was for sale at the store. The mother of Crawford's two infant children told the local paper she was on the phone with Crawford and heard him say, "It's not real," before police open fire. A special grand jury will convene in the case next month. The nation's capital continues to be the center of activism around the killing of Michael Brown and the issues of police brutality and militarism. Before last night's town hall at Busboys and Poets, which was broadcast here on WPFW, on the ground was outside the Justice Department, where more than 100 people gathered for a series of demands, including the arrest of Darren Wilson, the police officer who killed Michael Brown. Here's a voice from that rally.
No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
We stand today to demand justice for the death of Michael Brown. We stand today to demand the arrest of overseer Darren Wilson.
That's right. That's right.
We stand today to demand the federal task force be created to take action against the demilitarization of neighborhood policing across America. We stand today to demand the police officers wear video cameras on their persons. We stand today to tell America it's time to end institutional racism now.
Now.
The death and the treatment of Michael Brown is not an isolated case in America. For the black man, the treatment of Michael Brown by police overseers across the United States is the norm. For there is a study that shows every 28 hours a black person is killed by the police.
That's right. That's right.
And so we stand today to tell the racist overseer in the big city and in the small town, no more.
All right.
No more killing our children. No more beating our fathers. No more manhandling our women. We say no more.
No more.
Now, some say we are not patriotic because we are standing up to the police and America. I say to these misdirected individuals that we support the officers who serve the people,
right,
but not the overseers who stand over the people.
That's right.
We support the officers who protect us,
that's right,
but not the overseers who target us. We support the officers who attempts to build relationships with us, but not the overseers who see us as animals who need to be locked away in a cage. Finally, we say to America, you should be afraid. You have awakened your worst nightmare. You have awakened the hip-hop generation. You have awakened the boys in the hood. You have awakened those who you have counted out. And unless you repent from your sins, unless you remove the barriers of systematic racial injustice, you will fall a great fall. America, you must change your ways. For the Bible says righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any man. You may have knocked us down, but you didn't knock us out. You've tried water hoses. You've tried angry dogs. You've tried jail and prison. But the more you knock us down, the more you beat us down, I promise you, we will continue to get up. We will keep marching. We will keep fighting. We will remain the course. And listen, remember, weeping may endure for a night, but I'm so glad that joy will come in the morning light.
All right.
Hands up.
Hands up.
Hands up.
Don't shoot.
Hands up.
Don't shoot.
Hands up.
Don't shoot.
Hands up.
That was the Reverend George Gilbert speaking yesterday outside the Justice Department. Protests are continuing here in Washington, D.C. Today, the civil rights organization Color of Change, along with other organizations, will deliver a petition with more than 900,000 signatures to the White House, where they will hold a rally beginning at 5 p.m. At 7:30 p.m., there will be a town hall meeting sponsored by the National Moment of Silence Coalition at the Human Rights Campaign, 1640 Rhode Island Avenue in Northwest D.C. In other news, environmental activist Daniel McGowan has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Prisons for jailing him in solitary confinement after he wrote an article about his earlier imprisonment. McGowan spent more than 5 years in prison for arson as a member of the Earth Liberation Front. For part of his term, he was held in the prison's Highly Restrictive Communications Management Unit, or CMU. New evidence has emerged in the police killing of Michael Brown. On Monday night, CNN aired an audio tape which allegedly captured the moment Brown was shot. On the recording, at least 10 gunshots can be heard. Also in Ferguson, a St. Louis police officer, Dan Page, has been suspended after a video emerged of him boasting of the numbers of people he has killed and calling President Obama an illegal alien. Other officers are also being investigated for the killing of a mentally challenged young man 20 seconds after arriving at the scene of a petty robbery. The killing of Michael Brown is bringing renewed attention to other questionable deaths in police custody, such as the case of Marley Graham in the Bronx, and in Missouri, the case of Victor White III, who state police said shot and killed himself in March. While White was handcuffed with his hands behind his back, police claimed that he pulled a gun and shot himself in the back. The New Iberia Parish Coroner's Office has ruled the death a suicide. However, according to the autopsy, the bullet entered White's chest, not his back. Protocol at the Iberia Parish Sheriff's Office requires that deputies check suspects for weapons before they are placed into a police car. According to State Police Master Trooper Brooks David, the investigation is still open. And finally, residents in Washington State have continued to protest the Israel assault and blockade on Gaza by trying to block a cargo ship run by the Israeli company Zim. One person was arrested after scores of people gathered at the port of Seattle. The protesters said they plan to continue their actions. Now, for our moment of culture and media this week, we are joined by Richard Prince of the Journalism's Column. Good morning, Richard.
Morning. Good to be back.
Yes. Now, with the release of audio that may have documented 10 shots fired by Darren Wilson at Michael Brown, it looks like new smartphone and digital technology continues to shape the news and how news is gathered. I know we were going to talk about something, but I just wanted to get if you had any thoughts on that, because smartphones and what we can do now and what journalists can capture and what average citizens can capture is really shaping what we see on the news. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that one thing that needs to be emphasized is at the rallies and at the protests and all these things, it's fine to vent and to talk about the nature of structural racism and all that. But what can we as individual citizens and professionals and journalists do to chip away at these impediments to our progress?
Right.
In other words, what is the plan? Venting is fine, but what are we going to do about this? What's going on in the voting booth? What's going on inside the Justice Department? What's going on inside the city councils and the police departments? And how can we influence that?
Okay.
Where are the voting registration drives? Where is the canvassing to make sure that the next time there's an election, there are a sufficient number of people of color? What's being done about the increased militarization of the police department,
mm-hmm.
and how can we monitor that and speed the demilitarization along? I think these are things that that need to be explored by journalists, and are being explored by journalists,
mm-hmm.
but also by leaders and citizens.
Okay.
So the whole business about the smartphones is good, but then what do we do now that we have that information?
Okay. Now, there was also an uproar this week over a New York Times profile of Michael Brown, which said that Brown, quote, was no angel, end quote. And this article received a lot of backlash. What are your thoughts about the article?
Well, it was unfortunate. It was written by a black journalist. That's important to note. John Elagon, who was the Midwest correspondent for the New York Times. It was his idea to do a profile of Michael Brown. And in the process of doing the profile, he started out by talking about a vision that Michael Brown had that involved angels and devils. And then he went on to say, but he was no angel. Well, that phrase, he was no angel, was lifted out and became the focus of the controversy. And my initial thought about all this is, not only is it tragic, he has apologized for using that phrase and said it was a mistake, but it also highlights the dilemma that a lot of black journalists in the mainstream media face. They are trying to elucidate and bring information to the fore, and sometimes they are criticized by the very community that they believe that they are trying to assist.
Right.
And this is yet another example of that. We if you're looking for another example of what can happen sometimes in the mainstream media, we have a black female journalist, who did a piece for ESPN about what the people in the locker room are saying about whether they want to be around Michael Sam.
Oh, right, I saw that, yeah.
Right. Okay, now that's the kind of story that I'm sure that, you know, she would not have done had she not thought that this is the kind of thing that ESPN wants. It was, you know, ill-considered. It was not appropriate. She's now been ridiculed. But these are the kind of things that people are sometimes forced into when they are trying to fit in with the culture of their employer.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Richard.
That's it?
I'm speaking to Richard Prince, editor of the Journalism's column. And thank you, Richard.
Okay, thanks again.
Okay. Okay, so that includes our headline segment and our moment of culture and media today. When we come back, the economic contours and links between Ferguson, the Middle East, and beyond. Stay with us.
Who want the dance hall to stop? Police! Who now want to see herbs a shop? Police! Who kill the youths from the block? Police! Them now want to hear truth. Muslims, Fox! Who want to see herbs a drive? Police! Are the easiest man to drive? Police! Them now want to see get to survive? Police! As we see them, get a youth half a dive. Hey, yo!
Welcome back to Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition. That was Police by Anthony B. I'm your host, Esther Averam. Well, as Michael Brown, unarmed teenager slain by police, was buried this week, and on the other side of the world, Hamas and Israel has agreed to open and end a ceasefire, those communities and the world are left to ask, now what? People here in the DMV and around the country are vowing to keep up the protests. There's a clear sense that this time is different, that people are saying enough is enough, and that people are ready to go to the mat. But go to the mat for what? As protests continue, many organizations have adopted a uniform set of demands, which include, for example, an independent and comprehensive federal investigation by the Department of Justice of the fatal shooting of Michael Brown, a comprehensive federal review and reporting of all police killings accompanied by immediate action to address the unjustified use of lethal and excessive force by police officers in jurisdictions throughout the country against unarmed people of color, and a comprehensive federal review and reporting of excessive use of force generally against youth and people of color, and the development and national use of force standards. But does the Ferguson moment demand more? Maybe those of you I chat with on Facebook know that I gave big props to Bill Fletcher, host of Arise on WPFW, for talking about the need for the labor movement to be involved in this moment and to build a mass movement for justice and jobs. And so today with me to help me unpack this and talk about how the economy of what is happening in Ferguson relates to what is happening in Gaza and beyond is author and activist Gerald Horn, professor at the University of Houston and frequent commentator on the Pacifica Network. His most recent books are Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, and Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
I'm also joined by Salim Adofo, a national vice chair for the National Black United Front, that just helped organize a march that shut down Chinatown for a while on Saturday, I believe, here in D.C. The group is planning to shut down 8th Street this Saturday. Welcome, Salim.
Thank you for having me.
And joining me in the studio is Imani Akatopa, an activist and editor who just returned from Ferguson. Good morning, Imani.
Hello.
Well, I'm going to start with you, Imani, because you were just in Ferguson, and you know we're trying to kind of just talk about the economics of it. I've been really struck by the descriptions of people from people who live in Ferguson about how there are no jobs, about how there's a lack of training and, you know, poor schools, and also about how the jurisdiction seems to make money off of poor people by repeatedly giving them warrants. Like, you know, there was a statistic this week that each household gets like an average of like 3 warrants a year or something like that. And people are basically almost like in debtor's prison. They can't pay these tickets and things, and they wind up in jail. Did you get any sense of the frustration from people about the economics when you were in Ferguson?
Absolutely. I mean, it's no coincidence that these types of issues arise in communities that are struggling economically. You know, all these things that, you know, you just mentioned and that we've been witnessing come about from Ferguson and from other communities where we've seen murder and the oppression of communities of color, all these things are interrelated, right? So it's all a result of this framework that kind of tries to subdue the same communities of people, a framework that is intentionally trying to keep the rich rich and the poor poor. And this is exactly what we see going on right now.
Now, of course, you're also a Palestinian American activist and editor, and you've been advocating around issues around Palestinian rights. So at the same time, you know, this open-ended ceasefire in Gaza has occurred, and the fishermen are able to go out a little further, I think 3 miles more to mm-hmm. fish. But the blockade is still in effect in a sense. So can you tell us how Gazans are going to be impacted, you know, positively by this open-ended ceasefire, and what won't change?
I mean, obviously, we're all very relieved that finally Palestinians can actually go to sleep at night. Actually, a few hours ago, there were reports coming out from Palestine saying that Israeli soldiers had opened fire on some Palestinians. So really, it's also important to keep in mind that what we see on the media sometimes is, you know, just a wall that covers what's actually going on. There were plenty of times over the past month that we've heard reports of ceasefires occurring in Gaza between Hamas and Israel. But from us, like from the American Arab community, we'd be calling up our Palestinian families and our friends in Gaza, and they'd be telling us, like, no, there's bombing going on right now. Like, nothing changed. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely looking at this ceasefire with a critical eye. The Palestinian people have been celebrating, you know, a much needed and a much well-deserved celebration. But, you know, it is also imperative to remember that the blockade still hasn't been lifted. And the blockade is what's suffocating the people and keeping them in the world's largest open-air prison.
And, you know, actually, every time I mention Detroit and what's happening there in terms of the water crisis, I think about Gaza. And actually, every time I get a glass of water, I actually think about Gaza, because we take water for granted. And apparently, the water crisis there is intense. And people don't have water. They don't have access to drinking water. With the power stations being knocked out, that is also affecting power and just basic living conditions. So, you know, we definitely want to keep an eye on that. And I haven't heard from anyone about how those issues are going to be addressed. So we're definitely going to keep an eye on that. Salim, I wanted to ask you about the decision of the National Black United Front to look at the economic contours of Ferguson and your thinking behind kind of targeting commercial districts here in Washington D.C. to make your point.
Well, I would like to say that I think the issue is bigger than Ferguson and bigger than the death of Michael Brown, but we do want to give our condolences to the family of Michael Brown and show some solidarity and support for the sisters and brothers in Ferguson. But the issue of police violence is just connected to the broader issue as one of the residual effects of capitalism. You're going to need to have a military force that's in the community that's there to protect property in order for capitalism to work. And the death of Michael Brown, as well as Eric Garner and many of the unnamed people that we don't know, and many of the, you know, the rising number of black women that are being affected by police violence is one of the results of the occupation of the community by the police department. So in our minds, the National Black United Front, as well as WEAC Radio and the Party for Socialism and Liberation, as well as the Answer Coalition, decided that we needed to make that connection. But especially in Washington, D.C., which is the citadel of imperialism, that we know when we do things in Washington, D.C., that it gives us the opportunity to get the message out to the entire world. And that connection has to be made in order for people to understand and come up with the right solutions. The solutions just isn't limited to going into the polls, or isn't just limited to a police review board. We need to have a complete ideological shift in how we see policing in our community, how we see spending in our community, and be able to make the connection to the two.
Yes. So tell me a little bit about Saturday. I think that you targeted what we call the Chinatown area this past Saturday, but this Saturday you're going to be on H Street?
Yes, ma'am. We're going to gather at Union Station at 7 p.m. in Washington, D.C. That's on the red line. Everybody can just take the trains down to Union Station at 7 p.m., and then we'll proceed down A Street. The reason why we chose A Street, because that is one of the most gentrified areas, not only in Washington, D.C., but the entire DMV and throughout America. That was definitely a predominantly black area of Washington, D.C. at one time, and now people can't even afford to live there, pay the property taxes. It's difficult to set up businesses, and the police presence there is just, I mean, words really can't describe it.
Okay. So if people want to connect with your organization or the Saturday protests, how can they reach you?
They can contact me at blackunitedfront@gmail.com. Once again, that email address is blackunitedfront@gmail.com. They can visit our website at nbufdc.org. Also, we're on Facebook, Twitter, and all those other social media networks.
Okay. Well, thank you, Salim. So, Gerald, for the past 2 weeks on this show, we've been talking about From Gaza to Missouri and the links, of course. I mean, one of the links, of course, is the militarization and the killing, this equipment produced by the military-industrial complex. But as both places, you know, begin to pick up the pieces, you know, what do they also share in terms of the landscape of the world economy? You know, you and I have talked about austerity. We've talked about many countries suffering, and these seem to be just two flashpoints.
You are correct, but it even goes deeper than that. I was very disturbed by the reporting of the polls, the Pew polls and the New York Times poll, that suggested that many of those in this country defined as white did not see what the big deal was with regard to Ferguson. They refused to connect the dots. They see the killing of Michael Brown as just a one-off event. And that is nothing surprising, because historically we have faced, that is to say, people of color, people of African descent in particular, that kind of lethargy with regard to pressing issues that concern us. What we've done in the past is lengthen the battlefield, go to the international community for support. But when our representatives in the Congressional Black Caucus, with rare exception, have been rather silent with regard to Gaza, it becomes difficult to go to the international community for support. Likewise, I found it striking that some of the best coverage of Ferguson, Missouri has come from RT of Moscow and Press TV of Iran, not to mention China Daily. And so there is a wonderful opportunity to lengthen the battlefield, to go to the international community, particularly since the domestic forces, at least a good deal of them, seem to be aligned against us. And in that regard, I would point to a very disturbing article in the New York Times this past Saturday about the march to Staten Island over the death of Eric Garner, who boasts famously, when being smothered by police in an illegal chokehold, chanted, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." What the New York Times reported was that many members of the United Federation of Teachers objected to this march and are now threatening to dislodge the leadership of the union. Now, that's the kind of approach that makes it very difficult for us to ever seek to attain justice in Ferguson or Staten Island or anywhere else in this country.
Well, you know, I actually noted the coalition of unions that had participated in that march, and it was actually good that so many unions did come together, and I think they did so despite the objections and protests of the police union. So the police union was protesting the fact that so many unions were involved in the protest and participated, and, you know, it could be that, you know, of course, many cops could be married to teachers, right? And so you have a faction there that will say, okay, you know, I feel differently about this, and so they're mounting that protest. But it's very interesting that you noticed that. We're going to pick this up when we come back, Gerald. I hope you can stay on the line with us. But I want to thank Salim Adofa of the National Black United Front and also Amani Akatopa for joining us with this segment. We will be right back.
To be what you wanted us to be. We are what we are. That's the way it's going to be. If you don't know, you can't educate us or no equal opportunity. Talking about my freedom, people free.
Excuse me, buddy, but where can I be? You fooling, ain't you? This ain't America. Oh, Lord, where can I be? This ain't America. You can't fool me. In America, folks don't run through the streets, blood streaming from where they've been beat. And the cops in the good old USA don't think they some kind of gods either. No, this ain't America. You can't fool me. Those words were written 44 years ago by Melvin Van Peebles for his album As Serious as a Heart Attack, and they sound like they were written last week. Life imitates art. Something's gone rotten. Smells like justice and liberty. The song continues as if the author could see decades into the future to the moment when a Staten Island cop used a chokehold that was forbidden by his own department to murder Eric Garner, whom he suspected of selling loose cigarettes. Loose cigarettes? I can't breathe, Garner complained. He lay dying in the street, emergency medical technicians watching, but doing nothing to assist him. This ain't America. You can't fool me. Could Van Peebles have seen Ferguson, Missouri last week, where police officer Darren Wilson shot unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown down like an animal, according to witnesses, who said Brown's arms were raised over his head in surrender? No, Van Peebles had no crystal ball. Hands up. Don't shoot, protesters declared. Love, that's America. It's what the song is called, but you couldn't prove that by the 51-year-old woman who was beaten senseless by a cop on the side of a highway. You couldn't prove that by the dead man who held a toy gun in a Walmart store until he was murdered by police. Love, that's America, Van Peebles declared, but you couldn't prove that by me. And so now the nation seethes. 49 years to the day after the Watts riot boiled over in Los Angeles, leaving 30 dead and 3,000 arrested because of this same kind of police brutality. What century are we living in? What country is this? Excuse me, buddy, but where can we be? This ain't America. You can't fool me. I'm Askia Muhammad, WPFW News Director.
We refuse to be what you wanted us to be.
That was Babylon System by Bob Marley on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, where we lift up voices of social justice and activism on the mighty WPFW in Washington, D.C., your station for jazz and justice, your listener-powered station here in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Verum, joined today on the line by the author and activist Gerald Horn, and in the studio by activist and editor Amani Alcatopa. It's also your turn to call in, so go to 202-588-0893 to comment on our topics today. As we approach Labor Day, what do the tragedies of Ferguson, Gaza, and throughout the world tell us about the economic conditions of those communities and our communities? Can the groundswell of activism that has emerged around Ferguson be directed toward justice and jobs? 202-588-0893. Gerald, I wanted to ask you about reports this week that the black households of Ferguson are served with an average of like 3 warrants each year, and that the town counts, or the county depends on the paying of these fines as like the third biggest budget line or portion of its revenue, some $21 million annually. And as a result, there's kind of like the equivalent of like a debtor's prison developing there. People can't pay these fines, and so they wind up in jail for like because of tickets. It's happening, you know, on different kinds of levels around the country. Do you see that in your research or the things you observe and read?
Be from St. Louis, Missouri, so I'm quite familiar with this process, which has deep roots. You should know that Ferguson, Missouri which is the so-called suburb on the border of the city of St. Louis, only has a population of about 21,000 and does not have the revenue base to support a city council, police department, etc. So therefore, it basically grabs the young black men by the ankles. They're the ones who are disproportionately detained and stopped by the police, and then turns them upside down and shakes money out of their pockets and gives them tickets and then puts them in jail until they pay those tickets. And that's something that's quite common in the county of St. Louis, which borders the city and is much larger than the city of St. Louis. In fact, in terms of long-range solutions for St. Louis and other municipalities similarly situated, we need to consider some sort of consolidation of all these small municipalities, of which there are many in the county of St. Louis, that don't have a revenue base and therefore feel compelled to shake down their black citizens.
Right. You know, and I've actually been really interested for a while in the idea that, you know, more and more jobs are in the service to, like, the military-industrial policing complex, and then these jobs are predominantly held by white men who hire each other. When you're, for a lot of people out here looking for work, for looking for jobs, you know, so much of what is available will be in the military, in police, in, you know, in service to that, you know, complex. And it just seems to me, and then they're taking the money to kind of support that complex. You know, one of the things that's come from this whole exploration of Ferguson is, you know, people objecting to our money going to policing for military equipment as opposed to education, jobs. And, you know, that's what we're trying to talk a little bit about today. We actually have our first callers. So, caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Tespa, calling from Arlington. Good morning, Dr. Horn. Good morning, Asha.
Good morning.
Someone is not tied in newspapers or on TV or on internet. When this is done, it indicates that a verdict has already been passed and they are trying to sway public opinion to approve the verdict. And this is done under dictatorships or under apartheid system like the old South Africa. And this is being done in my own country right now. A famous political leader is being blamed and a documentary is being prepared against Andarga Cheptegei by the dictatorial Ethiopian government. That's happening in the United States itself. New York Times is already accusing the disease, and other news agencies are doing the same. This is an indication of the dictatorship in that town where Mike Brown was killed. The system in that town is an apartheid system, and it is a dictatorship. Why? Because the majority is segregated. The majority is not allowed to participate in government. The majority is not even allowed the freedom of movement. You see? This shows dictatorship. This shows apartheid. This is not a justice system. This is a system to a system of injustice and segregation and apartheid and dictatorship, just like my own Ethiopia.
Okay. Thank you, Tesfa. You know, he raises some really interesting points, because I meant to mention, Amani, the reports about people being so restricted in their movement in Ferguson because of the almost like kind of trying to avoid the police. You know, like, I can't go into the county because they'll stop me, they'll run my plate, you know, I'll wind up getting tickets, who knows, I might wind up in jail. And I thought about, you know, last week when we had Jaziri X's piece about the checkpoint and you know, really the wall in Gaza, I mean, the walls there, just the walls that create and checkpoints that create a system of apartheid, in addition to the different resources being used for different communities. Did you want to mention, respond in any way to what Tesfa said, Gerald?
Well, I think Tesfa will make some good points. I should also add, you may have noticed the op-ed by the dean of the law school at the University of California at Irvine, Irwin Chomorinsky, points out that the U.S. Supreme Court has, in recent decisions, stacked the deck in favor of police officers who have lethal encounters with civilians like Michael Brown. This morning, St. Louis Post-Dispatch reports that law professors at St. Louis University have said that with regard to Missouri state law, as things stand now, it's quite likely that Officer Darren Wilson will not be forced to walk the plank, that he will be acquitted because the law has been stacked. So obviously we need extraordinary measures in order to countervail what we're up against. Historically, once again, that has involved going to the international community, but quite frankly, I don't see that kind of activism as we speak.
Okay. We have a few callers on the line. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
My name is William. I'm calling from Alexandria, Virginia. And I think the gentleman is right. This has long been very similar to an apartheid system. And I think that once it gets to that point, or even close to it, it becomes the sole function of this Justice Department of the United States to go in and dismantle that. There has nothing to do with the governor, the mayor, none of that. Because every citizen in that state has their rights violated under the Constitution. So it automatically goes right by all that governorship and all of that and solely rests at the top of the...
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I think we may have lost that call. So let's go to our next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, Tony from Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Notwithstanding all of the violence, all of the demonstrations, all of the hate on every side, we must put this in focus. It's only been 60 years since Brown versus Board of Education, and it's only been 50 years since the Civil Rights Act were passed in 64 and 65. 60 years is not going to erase almost 400 years of slavery. And we need to take advantage of this opportunity, as sad as it may be and as tragic as it may be, to educate our people. We seem to believe that just because we had a few laws passed, we could move into some neighborhood, shop in some places, that we have attained some measure of freedom. But it's going to take generations to change the mindset of America about its people. And we have to be at the forefront of that. What is not being taught in our school systems, in our homes, must be taught in our houses of worship, our temples, our mosques, and our churches.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And I think we have another caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Mike, and I'm calling from Prince George's County.
Okay.
And I have a couple of questions for Dr. Horn. One, I'd like to, one, just ask him, why does he think that there has not been an armed resistance developed by African Americans, as you've seen in other places around the world where oppression has reigned? And then I have another question. My next question is, what do you think the response would be if, say, another superpower like, say, the U.S., Russia, or Germany, or someplace like that, did what the United States has done vis-a-vis Ukraine, Yemen, all those color revolutions where you had a small minority of people who were dissatisfied with their governments, and they were aided with all this equipment and weaponry to wage armed resistance?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Gerald, do you want to take a crack at any of those questions?
Point number one, the listener may want to consult my book, Farthest Time, The Watts Uprising in the 1960s, with regard to armed resistance against oppression in urban setting, this case being Los Angeles, or two, Negro Comrades of the Crown, which deals with the 19th century and armed resistance, including the sacking of Washington, D.C., the 200th anniversary we're marking, that is to say, August 1814, when the Africans joined the Redcoats in burning down Washington and claiming a kind of reparations by looting the White House. With regard to the second question, Well, obviously, the United States would be upset and enraged if there was internal interference in the internal affairs of this sovereign that is now known as the United States of America. But I don't think that that should detain or deter us one whit.
Okay. The we just marked, I guess, the 51st anniversary of the March on Washington, and I read that in 1963, the AFL-CIO did not endorse the march, but other unions like 1199 did, right? So, I mean, I thought it was significant that so many unions actually took part in the Staten Island rally this past Saturday. And, you know, and then, you know, we just talked earlier about how some of the teachers in the teachers union have kind of protested and they're trying to, like, dislodge their leadership or whatever. But, you know, how can we, what needs to happen so that those unions who are on board, who are, you know, on the side of the people and advocating for a crackdown on police brutality, this militarization of our communities. How can we, what needs to happen in your opinion so that unions can play a part and expand the conversation to justice and jobs?
Oh, you're asking me?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Well, obviously, the unions that are on board, and I would say in the forefront as ever, has been Dr. King's favorite union. I'm speaking of 1199, the hospital workers who are now part of SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, merit and deserve our congratulations. Those are the unions we should be highlighting. Those are the unions we should be seeking to encourage in terms of strength and encouraging other unions to emulate. And secondly, you may recall that when President Obama first came into office in early 2009, a major priority of the labor movement was labor law reform to make it easier to organize unions, which, of course, have been dwindling in numbers. Labor law reform has been sidelined. It needs to be put in the forefront in terms of this November 2014 election.
Right. Now, Imani, you know, in the last 2 weeks, we've also talked about U.S. tax dollars going to basically, you know, for arms for Israel and some of those same arms and equipment being used, you know, in the attack on Gaza. So in terms of the activists here organizing, what are some of the efforts being made to kind of target that, those tax dollars, to target the fact that our money is being used not for schools, not for training, not for to help, you know, communities like Ferguson, but going to, you know, bomb Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely an interesting topic. It also goes into when you mentioned Detroit and how there is a water crisis going on right now within our own country. And it's why is it that our money isn't going towards helping our own citizens, but yet we're funneling hundreds of millions of dollars into another country for a war that's against international law? Right now, we have the Stop the Blank Check campaign that's been launched by If Americans Knew, Code Pink, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and the intention of the campaign is to raise awareness about this fact. It's that we're literally giving a blank check to Israel. However much money they want from America for whatever actions they want to take, they can get. And it also gets tied into, you know, representation in this country and who's really making the decisions behind the scenes. There are definitely communities that are disenfranchised, and actually one of the things that I've seen, one of the biggest efforts on the ground in Ferguson right now are Get Out the Vote initiatives. So we were literally going around canvassing, helping register people to vote, et cetera. And while that's a great thing, you know, when we see communities try to push back against oppression by trying to integrate themselves within the system further, that's wonderful. But like what was mentioned by, you know, previous callers and even our previous speakers on air is that that doesn't necessarily mean that change is going to happen right off the bat. You know, just because you can vote doesn't mean that we're going to have a black politician rise up in the ranks that actually is going to represent the black community. That doesn't mean that we are not going to still have policies that try to completely marginalize voters from minority communities, just like what happened in Dearborn Heights in Michigan only a few weeks ago. So all these things are taken into account, and this is also a huge issue facing the Palestinian community as well when it comes to representation and trying to figure out who's making the decision or how we can affect that decision of how we choose to utilize our own tax dollars.
Okay. I think we have some more callers. We are getting a little short on time, so try to make your comments brief. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Ferguson is a mini Gaza Strip, one of the mini Gaza Strips in America. When George Wallace said segregation now, segregation forever, he wasn't speaking for him for himself.
Hmm.
He was speaking on behalf of his America.
Hmm. Wow. Thank you.
Can I add?
Go ahead.
Okay. I am suggesting no, our people, our community should be policed by Caucasian, no matter what. And the police, a police should be within, from within the community, not from Simi Valley, from anywhere, Ku Klux Klan. I think this should be the main policy of our people. No police should police us.
Okay. Thank you for that call. Next caller? Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, this Freedom in the D.C., I just want to comment that I think that, there needs to be a combination and a collaboration of works and organizations protesting and demonstrating against the police brutality, and not just police brutality, just the system of, as was described earlier, apartheid, that is not only in Ferguson, but is in a lot of communities across the country. But my main point would be that, yeah, but all that needs to be taken seriously, that we need to think sober-mindedly about the fact that there has to be a defense for the black community. We can no longer move into the position where we think that allowing the police to defend us or do anything for us is going to be sufficient. We have to develop defense mechanisms for us to survive in America or deal to get out of America, one way or the other.
Okay. Well, thank you, Freedom. And that will do it for us on the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Rivera. And special thanks to our guest, Gerald Horn. And thanks to our contributors, Amani Alcatopa and Richard Prince. And also to Salim Adofo of the National Black United Front. Thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening and calling in. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our past shows. We have them archived there. And please like our Facebook and Twitter pages. I really have to get up our likes on Facebook, you know. So you can stay tuned for Askia Muhammad with the news, followed by Chris DeProperty on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Don't forget today, the civil rights organization Color of Change, along with other progressive groups, will deliver a petition with 900,000 signatures to the White House, where they will hold a rally beginning at 5 p.m. At 7:30, there will be a town hall meeting sponsored by the National Moment of Silence Coalition at the Human Rights Campaign, 1640 Rhode Island Avenue, here in the district. And on Saturday, the National Black United Front is part of a coalition that is shutting down 8th Street. So, happy Labor Day. We'll continue this conversation next week. Peace.